That is the sound you never want to hear. It is the sound of the warning siren going off at a nuclear power plant. But whether you can hear that sound or not, we are all in the nuclear hot seat. Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly podcast keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island. If you've ever wondered why there's no news about Fukushima in the mainstream media, how this media blackout is enforced virtually worldwide, then today's interview connects the dots from before Hiroshima to now about how the media has been gamed and manipulated to hide the truth about nuclear from you. Carl Grossman is arguably our best, most respected journalist, and today he shares his expertise honed over 45 years of reporting in an extended Nuclear Hot Seat interview. We'll get to that in a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 16, 2012, and here is the week's nuclear news. From the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Southern California Edison's juggernaut of a meeting last week that they gamed completely. This was supposed to be the big public meeting about San Onofre. There will be more about this at the end of the podcast. 2 days after this big meeting about how transparent they were going to be about the dealings at San Onofre, Nuclear Hot Seat has learned that San Onofre is already preparing for a restart before November 1st. That's the date when they would become legally responsible for refunding ratepayer money that has been paid in over the last 9 months for a non-functioning nuclear power plant. According to a report received by Nuclear Hot Seat via San Clemente Greens, and which came from a whistleblower inside San Onofre, this individual said, quote, "We are working on Unit 2, bringing it up from Mode 5 to 4, and we are preparing to go from Mode 4 to 3 by the weekend of the 20th. They assigned 12-hour shifts, and they are making damn sure that no steam leaves the domes for fear that the public will catch on. I can't believe how audacious they are, but for all practical purposes, they are going to restart Unit 2, which is still highly radioactive, without the NRC thoroughly reviewing Edison's application that was just submitted. Their motivation is to see if they fixed the new reactor head, which leaked profusely the first time they tried it. They don't want anything holding them back from actually restarting when they get the green light from the NRC. The NRC's confirmatory action letter allows them to take it up to Mode 3 because the reactor is not, quote, critical, meaning the fission reaction is on hold. They are trying to beat the clock before time runs out on them, and the California Public Utilities Commission sticks Edison with the cost of the outage instead of ratepayers," end of quote. This test will be done at full power, with the compromised steam generator tubes under full stress. According to a respected expert on the nuclear issue, quote, "NRC on-site inspectors must know about this, as does Region 4 and NRC headquarters. It's not something that you can hide." So Southern California Edison is playing games with the lives and health of California citizens, our agricultural industry, fishing, shipping, real estate. In other words, the economy of our state, and beyond that, the country and the world, as well as the future of life on Earth. When is that story going to hit the media? This story out of Sweden. On Tuesday, October 9, 70 Greenpeace activists poured into two nuclear sites in Sweden in an effort to show how lax the security is at these plants. But at least six of them hid overnight at two of the plants, four at Ringhals and two at Forsmark. They evaded security all night and were only discovered when Greenpeace Sweden phoned the media early on Wednesday morning, October 10, to reveal their presence at the plants. This despite the fact that the plant operator, Vattenfall, said on Tuesday that, quote, "security had worked exactly as intended." Oh, dear. One of the overnighters, Greenpeace International energy campaigner Lori Milvirta, said, "I took part in this demonstration to draw attention to how little nuclear companies care about the health and safety of people and how little they do to protect reactors from accidents." There will be a picture and a link on the nuclearhotseat.com/blog page. Oh, here's a happy one. The United States will restart importing beef from Japan this month, ending a 30-month suspension. The suspension was imposed after foot-and-mouth disease was discovered in Japanese cows. Three cows will be processed in Japan, and the meat will be sold to upscale restaurants in the United States. Livestock farmers hope the resumption of exports will help to erase concerns about radioactive contamination. In this whole story in the United States, nobody is saying the R word, radiation. So if you really must eat Kobe beef at approximately $500 per steak, I hope you work for the nuclear industry. Ooh, that was mean of me. Oh, well. A group of Massachusetts citizens is planning to use the Clean Water Act to sue Entergy Corporation for environmental violations at their Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. The group says the company should pay nearly $1 billion in penalties, saying that the plant has polluted Cape Cod Bay, massively killed local fish populations, and the operators kept inadequate environmental records. Entergy could be liable for over $800 million in penalties. Here's the important thing for activists to pay attention to. Citizens have the right to sue when the government fails to enforce the Clean Water Act. So if the EPA does not step in within 60 days, this plaintiff group can proceed. And if the issue is relevant to the nuclear plant in your area, so can you. Lithuanians, in a show of uncommon good sense, rarely matched in the United States, have rejected a plan to build a nuclear plant to cut dependence on imports of Russian energy. This took place in a non-binding referendum that does not kill off the project, but leaves a big question mark over its future. With results counted from all but a handful of Lithuania's districts, almost 63% voted no, while only 34% were in favor. But the referendum on Sunday was consultative, so Lithuania's leaders are not obliged to scrap the power plant. Note that the Japanese-U.S. joint venture of Hitachi GE Nuclear Energy was lined up to build the plant. That particular factoid will mean more to you after you hear today's interview. The Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission has ordered a shipment of radioactive kitchenware that found its way into the port of Montreal to be taken out of the country. André Regimbault, the director of nuclear substance regulations for the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, said Canada has seen an increase in contaminated packages coming from Asia since 2011. Canadian officials have intercepted about 15 shipments with radiation levels above the permitted threshold since the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant meltdown in Japan. Gordon Edwards, who is a spokesman for the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, said, "I think it shows that our regulator is really lax, that they don't act very quickly, and also act with a lot of due deliberation, because simply sending it back to where it came from, there's no guarantee that it won't be sent to some other consumer somewhere else in the world. The container is being sent back to India, which was the shipping point. Do not accept kitchenware from India." And here is not just nuclear numbnuts, it is evil nuclear numbnuts. That's because the nuclear industry in India has published a glossy coffee table book featuring images of butterflies at nuclear plants. Having shot butterflies in the exclusion zones that surround each nuclear power reactor, the locations were not mentioned, the book begins by explaining in brief the characteristic features of the zone of every reactor. The few photographs that go along with the text give the readers an idea of how verdant, how green, how lush these zones are. But no information in the book is provided on the severe abnormalities found in butterflies, adult pale grass-blue butterflies, collected from near Fukushima's nuclear power plants after the catastrophe, or the radiation mutation in plants known as fasciation, a mutation that has shown up around the world and resulted in deformed plants, fruits, vegetables, and flowers. This week's interview with Carl Grossman was so powerful, so instructive, that we went double the usual length, and I still wanted to hear more from this man. Learn how the nuclear industry has gamed the media since before Hiroshima, why it's so tough to get any nuclear news on mainstream media, as well as some thoughts on what we the people can do to start breaking that logjam. Get out your pens and notebooks, folks, and fasten your seatbelts.
Carl Grossman has specialized in doing investigative reporting in a variety of media for more than 45 years. He's a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury, where his courses include investigative reporting. For over 20 years, he's hosted the nationally aired TV program, Enviro Close-Up, as well as written and presented TV documentaries, including 3 Mile Island Revisited, The Push to Revive Nuclear Power, and Nukes in Space, The Nuclearization and Weaponization of the Heavens. He is an associate of the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and the author of 6 books, including Cover-Up, which you are not supposed to know about nuclear power, Power Crazy, The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet, and Weapons in Space. He currently writes for The Huffington Post, Counterpunch, and it seems like any place else that will have him and his articles. Carl Grossman, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Yeah, pleasure.
Now, you are arguably the best journalist our side has produced, with decades of experience covering nuclear stories that leaves a trail of lucidity in their wake. What first drew you to writing about the nuclear problem and the nuclear issues?
Well, here where I live on Long Island in New York, there were plans in the 1960s to create in the parlance of the Atomic Energy Commission and the nuclear establishment then, a nuclear park out of Long Island. There were to be 7 to 11 nuclear plants on Long Island providing nuclear-generated electricity to the whole northeastern megalopolis. Shoreham, the Shoreham nuclear power plant, was to be the first of this amalgam. I was an investigative reporter at that time for the Long Island Press, and I began investigating Shoreham, and I began investigating nuclear power in general.
You've referred to the current blackout on coverage about Fukushima as the biggest cover-up in history, certainly in the media. How has this been allowed to happen? What is our history with nuclear, and how has it come to this point that we can't seem to get any news in the media visible?
What we're undergoing now, which is a huge cover-up, indeed, the first book I wrote about nuclear power, it's titled Cover-Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, and cover-up is the operative word when it comes to nuclear technology, the suppression of information. It's been going on since the advent of nuclear technology, keeping people in the dark, not letting us know about the lethality of this technology. March of last year, the catastrophe of Fukushima, we're living not just in the aftermath. I mean, that's an ongoing disaster, an ongoing catastrophe. But you wouldn't know it from media. I mean, there's nothing. When was the last time you read or heard or saw regarding mainstream media and any information about Fukushima? People, lots of people, are going to end up dead, not just in Japan, but all through the world, because of the radioactivity released and continuing to be released out of those, we're talking about 6 nuclear power plants at Fukushima Daiichi. But the media have been basically silent. I mean, Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister, would smile in his grave to see how the nuclear establishment has handled quite successfully the Fukushima disaster.
How has this been possible for a story of this magnitude to be manipulated out of public consciousness so that even the best, most dedicated reporters are either not able to cover it, or if they cover it, they aren't able to get their stories placed?
There's a long story behind that lack of story. The beginning was the Manhattan Project. This was the crash program during World War II to build atomic weapons. And Leslie Groves was the head of the Manhattan Project, and he made a special visit to the New York Times, and he made arrangements, Leslie Groves did, to hire the Times science reporter, William Lawrence, at the Manhattan Project. An excellent book on this. I mean, I've written a lot about it, but a superb book that I would recommend is News Zero, The New York Times and the Bomb by Beverly Kiever. She details in the book how General Groves goes to the Times, negotiates with its publisher and its top editorial people, having Lawrence go out to the Manhattan Project. His salary, she writes, would continue to be paid by the Times to his wife while he would be on government salary. This is the beginning of disinformation on nuclear.
So these meetings took place actually before the atom bomb was created, but while it was still in the developmental process and it was still completely hidden. Is that correct?
Manhattan Project was an ultra-secret project But in the thinking of those behind it, even then, controlling the press, suppressing the press, lying to the press was pivotal. I mean, you could defend some of what happened to a degree. It was World War II and so forth. Well, for example, when the United States first tested a nuclear device, it was called the Trinity Test. It was out in New Mexico.
Alamogordo.
This is the Alamogordo bombing range. This is a month before the bombs were actually dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They would have this device explode in the middle of the night, and it would light up, and it did light up a good portion of the Southwest. How to keep that from an inquiring media? How to lie about it? Well, Lawrence, the New York Times reporter, it turns out, writes a press release prepared to be issued once this device is ignited, claiming there had been an ammunition dump explosion. It's given to the Associated Press when inquiries begin to mount, and that's what the press went with. A very small story had been that there was an ammunition dump explosion at the Alamogordo range.
So this is the start of the media manipulation, that we were not being forthcoming even at the beginning. There may have been security reasons back then, but they were already thinking far in advance of how to spin the story to take people's eyes off of what was actually happening.
As you say, it was the war, there were security reasons and so forth, but what soon happens is equally outrageous. Lawrence pleads to go on the Enola Gay, the B-29 that drops the first atomic bomb to be used in war on Hiroshima. They wouldn't let him on the Enola Gay. They allowed him on a chase plane that followed the bomber that went into Nagasaki. But the bombs are dropped, and then he writes a story. I mean, I've seen it on microfiche in the New York Times about now. He writes about the Trinity test being present. It was like being present at the creation. I mean, he lauds what he has seen. And furthermore, he has prepared, Lawrence, a 10-part series on the wonders, the glories of the Manhattan Project, which is distributed by his paper. Now he's back in New York, his paper, the New York Times, to papers, newspapers all around the country for free. And the series does not use the word, hardly at all, radioactivity, period. And then Lawrence goes on and on for years. Writing about the wonders, the great things about nuclear technology.
So we have a basis already for the first news about this new technology being rigged. It's all pre-written. He's lauding it. He's on the side. He's actually been in the pay of the nuclear industry, the nascent nuclear industry, the government, before he actually gets the story out, but it's already prearranged that it was going to be positive with no criticism. So from that point to later in the process, how did the media evolve around the nuclear issue?
From right off, William Lawrence is one reporter for a very important newspaper. That's why Groves went to the Times, considered the paper a record. But this becomes emblematic of the general situation. For example, just let me read perhaps the first couple of sentences in my book, Cover Up. You've not been informed about nuclear power. You have not been told, and that's been done on purpose. Keeping the public in the dark was deemed necessary by the promoters of nuclear power if it was to succeed. Those in government, science, and private industry who have been pushing nuclear power realized that if people were given the facts, if they knew the consequences of nuclear power, they wouldn't stand for it. If people knew that the kind of accidents that happened at Three Mile Island, this book was written in 1980, at the Fermi reactor, at Browns Ferry, at Windscale, at SL1, among others, the sort of huge catastrophes which have only barely been avoided ought to be expected. They'd be damned upset and would insist a stop be put to nuclear power. So an army of public relations practitioners has been working for decades to, in the jargon of the trade, make the people think of Citizen Adam as a friend before the truth became manifest. How they did it, a variety of ways. In terms of public relations, and Edward Bernays is considered to be the father of public relations.
Which is a title that he gave himself.
Well, yes, he's quite a promoter, period. A nephew of Sigmund Freud, incidentally. And he defined PR as engineering public consent. There's an excellent book called Propaganda, which he talks about how you do that, how you manipulate. And what occurred in the beginnings of this nightmare of nuclear technology is an army, literally an army of public relations people went to work. They worked at the National Nuclear Laboratories, which still to this day have huge PR staffs. They worked in the industry. And when you talk about nuclear power, nuclear technology, it isn't just big business. It's big government and big science working hand in hand with big media. So, any journalist who writes a story, if you're going to write a story about Fukushima, you're going to do a story about San Onofre, you do a story at Indian Point, you do it in a newspaper, you do it on an internet site, you do it on TV, you do it on radio, you can expect a reaction from a squad of this nuclear public relations army to get to your editor, to get to your news director almost immediately and begin to apply pressure. But it's more than that, too. It's who owns the media. I mean, the Coke and Pepsi of nuclear power worldwide are General Electric and Westinghouse. I mean, during that Manhattan Project, our government often contracts out work. You'll go to a government site and you'll see security is whack and hut. A government loves to do that. And during the Manhattan Project, a lot of the work was done by General Electric and Westinghouse, these two huge corporations. And afterwards, well, historically, 80% of nuclear power plants worldwide are of General Electric and or Westinghouse design and or manufacture. Again, the Coke and Pepsi of nuclear power. What company for decades owned NBC and all the various offshoots of the CNBC and the
General Electric.
What company for many years owned CBS?
But it was Westinghouse.
Westinghouse. So here you have, the Coke and Pepsi of nuclear power owning these media institutions that, if you believe in the press being a watchdog, that is the press's mission, and I believe that is the press's mission, and that, in fact, is the ideal in the United States for a
free and independent press so that we can hold the government's feet to the fire under any circumstance and be the informers to the public.
The framers of the Republic figured out we'll have checks and balances, a legislative and an executive judicial branch checking and balancing each other, and then a free press being a monitor, being a watchdog of the whole kit and caboodle. And those behind the nuclear juggernaut worked, they've endeavored for years to corrupt that, to compromise that role of the media, that role of the press, so they could continue with this. One can't imagine a more deadly way to boil water, which is all nuclear technology is about, using fission to boil water.
Carl, let's roll this back just slightly.
Shoot.
When you're talking about corporate ownership, I'm wondering, was there an actual mechanism in place that went from corporate owners to the network, to the individual station, to the news director, to the assignment editor, to the reporters? I mean, was there actual communication? Was it just an environment that got created? Were they under direct orders not to cover this? How do you think it became as entrenched as it has become today?
Well, again, it's a very complex and broad propaganda program, and it has to do with a lot of those things. I mean, in the United States, censorship mainly, the dynamic of censorship mainly is the sin of omission. You know, if you're working at GE's NBC, you know you're working at Westinghouse's CBS, you know there are certain things you just don't report on. That's one element of it. If you're just working at the Boise Bugle and you want to write about Idaho National Laboratory nearby in Idaho, you know that those folks from Idaho, the PR, the nuclear Pinocchios, the frankly liars for hire at Idaho National Laboratories or any of the national nuclear laboratories or any of the companies in the nuclear business, I mean, these folks, and I've dealt with them for decades, make the liars for hire, the Pinocchios of the Tobacco Institute, for example, which for decades, I mean, there is a bit of a comparison here, which for decades were able to cover up the relationship between smoking and cancer, and to keep the press in line, to suppress all that. I mean, for many decades, the nuclear establishment's PR operation really dwarfs what we had seen from the tobacco industry for many years. You know, if you're out there in Boise and you write the piece, your editor or your news director is going to get a call from somebody at Idaho National Laboratory. It's a combination of ownership, of PR manipulation, and then even further in cover-up, what I did to you, is to show interlocking boards of directors between media institutions. I have pages of this in the book, of media institutions and components of the nuclear industry. In fact, I even went further and showed where financing is often mutual, where bank money flows to, in this very well-orchestrated pattern, to both. I mean, the bottom line here is a massive cover-up. And if I could just jump back to a second to Fukushima, the Japanese media cover-up has not been that different, nor for different reasons. In fact, and this is one of the elements of the Fukushima story which has not been covered, in 2009, a company called Toshiba bought Westinghouse, and a company called Hitachi bought the nuclear division of General Electric. So now the Coke and Pepsi of nuclear power are really Japanese brands. To the listeners now, how many people have heard that? Among the lack of reporting is that. That's given a very important additional reason for the power elite in Japan to cover up emphatically, so fully.
And now we've had the problem that even though Japan made that, Prime Minister Noda made the announcement that he was going to set a path for no nukes by 2030, and then the 2030s, the U.S. stepped in with tremendous pressure, and they've had to backpedal from that position.
Well, and also the nuclear, in fact, it's called in Japan the nuclear mafia, which is a pretty good term. We're talking about Japan's nuclear interests, besides U.S. pressure. Has resulted in, oh, we're going to go renewable, we're going to do what Germany's done, we're going to, it's so nuts to have over 50 reactors on this chain of volcanic islands. I mean, catastrophe was being essentially asked for. But in terms of the media in Japan, the same sort of pattern that I've explained has been the situation here in this country for many decades. PR manipulation of dominator, but a lot in Japan had to do with advertising by the nuclear utilities and so forth. And since 2009, here you have these two huge gorillas in the nuclear technology field, Westinghouse and GE, coming out of Japan. So in many respects, the U.S. has created the model for, well, not just the promotion, the push for nuclear power and nuclear technology, but the model for the cover-up.
For the suppression of the genuine information. Well, Carl, as you are, I mean, we've all been aware of aspects of this, but this is really like a unified look at what we're up against and why press releases don't seem to work. We have such a hard time getting reports. Is there, in your vision, any media organization or outlet out there that has the power and the independence to cover this? And how can we, who are in the movement, move forward in such a way that we are getting this information out so that people can at least have the facts to consider around nuclear as opposed to just the manipulation?
Well, I think there's at least two routes here. One, people must do what they can to get media to move on the story. I mean, to call, to demonstrate, you know, to do the media event, the protests, the demonstrations that media will cover if they won't cover the very issues, to write those letters to the editor, to try to push mainstream, for what it's worth, as much as you can, to do what the press should do, to deal with the nuclear Pinocchios in the correct way, which is like, get off my back, let the reporters do the job that they're supposed to do. So try to do what one can with mainstream media. And while I'm on that subject, and this gets into a whole other area, the whole issue of reforming media in this country, and there's a whole important ongoing campaign to do something about the monopolization and consolidation of media in this country, the corporate control of media and so forth and so on. then the other major route has to do with, I mean, and this is very revolutionary, it's really only come about in recent times, using the new technologies of media, new media, like your media, to get the information out, to use the internet in full, to do what you're doing in terms of audio. I have a company, it's called a nonprofit, it's called Enviro Video. And over 20 years, we've produced television programs providing people with information which is, well, too hot for television, mainstream television. But you can just go to envirovideo.com, which is also programs are distributed on free speech TV to 200 cable systems around the country through DirecTV and
Well, you're going to give me a list of media connections, of online connections for that, and they will all be posted with the podcast so that people can just have some click-throughs to be able to start discovering these rich resources that you have.
They're rich resources, but what I'd like to say is people have to be empowered to make their own media. A very important issue in recent times about nuclear power is it's become clearly obvious that it's unnecessary, that safe, clean, renewable energy technology can absolutely substitute, can provide all the energy, all the power we need. So the other thing media feel they have to do is not just to sugarcoat nuclear technology and hide the awful dangers, even in the face of a Chernobyl, in the face of Fukushima, but to discard, to harshly criticize, to ignore the fact that say, clean, renewable energy technologies are here today and nuclear is not needed. And here on the East Coast, you take a paper like the New York Times, or even worse, Rupert Murdoch's New York Post, campaigning for, right now the Nuclear Regulatory Commission wants to extend the licenses of those two Indian Point plants, which are just 24 miles north of New York. The NRC has already extended the licenses. Nuclear plants were never seen as operating for more than 40 years because the radioactivity so embrittles the metals and just the machines cannot run safely after 40 years. This has always been the conclusion. And in any case, the NRC has now allowed more than 70 of the 104 nuclear plants in the U.S. to run to 60 years, is talking about allowing them to run for 80 years. 80 years, can you imagine?
That was when they introduced a campaign called Is There Life After 60?
Wow.
You know, they were trying to make a joke out of it, but they introduced the idea, and then they start building on it, and that becomes the campaign.
Imagine being in a car 70 years old rolling along on your local interstate. And not only have they been doing the license extensions, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is really the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Commission for the industry and the nuclear establishment, but the NRC has been rubber stamping uprating, in other words, allowing these nukes to run hotter and harder. I mean, speaking of asking for disaster, but meanwhile, as I say, there's the New York Times and there's the New York Post and there's Newsday, another major newspaper in the New York metropolitan area, saying, no, we should allow these Indian Point plants, which are also on earthquake faults like Fukushima.
Well, and also the terrorists from 9/11 flew directly over Indian Point, and it was actually considered as one of the possible targets.
Oh, yeah. No, it wouldn't have been 3,000 Americans dead if it was the American Airlines plane.
Mm-hmm.
If it would have, instead of hitting the World Trade Center, dropped down on one of those nuclear plants just again, north of the Bronx line. And, in fact, Al-Qaeda had been then and today considering attacks on nuclear power plants. In my judgment, it's so clear that we must close every nuclear power plant, period, and not in 20 years or 10 or 2, now.
Right now, and then let's figure out what to do with the radioactive waste, which is a whole other issue. But I want to get the focus back on the media.
Yep.
So if you were to advise a small local group that has gotten together around their neighborhood nuclear issues, be it a plant, be it former uranium mining, be it radioactive contamination. We here in Los Angeles have the very rarely spoken about and virtually unknown nuclear accident that happened in 1959 at the Santa Susana Field Lab in Simi Valley. If you were to advise us in ways to get our media message out, or our message out to the media in a way that they would actually hold on to it, what would your suggestions be?
Again, there's many, many paths here. One, get your whistleblowers. And there are whistleblowers. There are, thank God, honest people around still in this world. And some of them have ended up working for the nuclear industry and establishment. Find them or welcome them to come to you and seek to get their story out. The problem is the nuclear establishment will try to discredit those whistleblowers, and with a compliant media often succeeds. But the whistleblower, the insider telling about the disasters waiting to happen, the catastrophes waiting to happen at these nuclear plants all over the country, very important. Secondly, there's the issue of you don't need a catastrophic accident for radioactivity to be released. Every nuclear plant routinely, it's called permissible to our government emissions. They're forever giving off xenon gas and tritium is flowing out. And the consequence has been the Radiation and Public Health Project is a great source for information about this. The result has been cancer, and we know about the cancer epidemic in our country.
The mysterious cancer epidemic that nobody seems to be able to figure out what it's based on, quote unquote.
Yeah, I mean, if you believe the nuclear Pinocchios and the others who say it's not us or in the chemical industry, you know, it's all lifestyle, diet, genetics. But in fact, there are cancer clusters around every nuclear power plant in this country, and the Radiation and Public Health Project. Just go to radioactivity.org on the internet, and you can see the important studies on that. Again, a third route is that this toxic technology is, as I say, not necessary. And to communicate to media, or again, getting back to making one's own media, with one's websites, with the zines, with pod broadcasting, with video, with, you know, on and on in terms of so-called new media, show, explain how, whether it's solar or wind or geothermal, I mean, each part of it, or tidal, wave action, each part of the country, each part of the world would have a different mix. But we could power our society safely. One of the other things, going back to history, what's so important to understand this history, in my work, both in print and books and magazine articles and on TV, I speak about those few years after the Manhattan Project, 46, 47, 48, and the desperation at those national laboratories that were set up then at Oak Ridge, at Argonne, at Los Alamos in particular. I mean, we can continue to build nuclear weapons, which the U.S. did, 30,000 nuclear weapons, including the super, the hydrogen bomb under Edward Teller, who was given his own national nuclear laboratory, Lawrence Livermore. But, I mean, there's a limit of how many bombs you can, I mean, you couldn't sell, can't sell to this day an atomic bomb to even an ally, even to England. What else could be done with nuclear technology to perpetuate the vested interest created during the war, not just these...
All these jobs, all this money that was flowing into the laboratories and the research.
Right, and the corporations too, the Westinghouse and GE and so on. So in those years, 46, 47, 48, come these schemes to use, there was something called Project Plowshare. We'll use nuclear devices as a substitute for dynamite. You would have nuclear-powered airplanes, nuclear-powered rockets, which I've written a lot about, and that's not over now. Yet, I mean, the plan now is to have a Mars mission with a nuclear-powered rocket.
Well, the Curiosity has a nuclear reactor powering it on the surface of Mars right now.
That was the first rover sent to Mars, and I've written a lot about that. The earlier rovers were solar-powered, and that worked fine. But then suddenly we needed a plutonium-powered rover, and that's what Curiosity is. In fact, NASA and the Department of Energy and their environmental impact statement for Curiosity set the odds of plutonium being released on this mission. I mean, 1 out of 100 chemical rockets explodes at launch. There's been accidents in the U.S. nuclear space program with the worst was in 1964, a SNAP-9A plutonium system aboard a satellite came hurtling back to the Earth with the satellite. It failed to achieve orbit. It disintegrated in the atmosphere, spreading plutonium-238, which is actually more radioactive than the plutonium-239 that's produced in nuclear power plants or is used in weapons. Spreading plutonium-238 all over the planet. Indeed, Dr. John Goffman, the University of California at Berkeley, an MD, PhD, in fact, earlier involved in the Manhattan Project until he saw the light, speaking of honest people, had long connected the SNAP 9A accident in 64 to the spike at the time of lung cancer globally. And in fact, if you look at a book on solar photovoltaic, you'll see how NASA was a pioneer in solar power. Yeah, why? Because of this disaster involving the SNAP 9A, and it went to solar power then for satellite. The International Space Station is powered by satellite. So this can be done, whether it's to power satellites or the space station or a rover for Mars with solar, or power our world with solar and wind and geo. It all can be done. The key here, back to, you know, the issue of media, is often if you don't have a press, a vigilant, tough media, an honest, independent press being there, things are going to get out of hand, really get out of hand. And again, from the very beginning, from the outset, those behind the nuclear push realized that they would have to, in any way they could, suppress the press, to limit the press, to control the press, to cover up, and they have, and it's a matter of life and death. It's our life and death. It's our job today. It's our mission today. It's our great need today to somehow break the cover up. To have people understand, I mean, when people understand, like after Fukushima, for example, where people got the information and then where they had, and this is very important, to some sort of democratic process to exercise their discretion. For example, in Germany, after Fukushima, suddenly the folks there really got the message. The Greens won politically. The chancellor of the nation, despite her scientific background, did 180. All 23 nuclear power plants in Germany, which incidentally were made by Siemens, plans were to close them down as soon as possible. And Siemens, incidentally, this rather big company, took the position that we're out of the nuclear business. We're going to be in the renewable. We're going to be in the safe, clean energy business. In Italy, there was, thankfully, media attention to Fukushima. And Berlusconi had wanted to revive nuclear power in Italy, but there happened to be a referendum scheduled. And boom, 93% of the Italian voters voted against it, the end of a nuclear revival in Italy and so forth and so on. So
really the suppression that's going on here is crucial to a continuation of a multi-billion dollar industry from people who don't see that you can't do anything with money when you have killed off the future of life on Earth.
Yes. And just to jump to the American political scene, I mean, Congress is in the pocket of both the nuclear industry and these national nuclear laboratories all over the place. Again, it's just not just the nuclear industry. If it would just be big business, that would be one thing. But it's as I say, big business and big government.
This issue is so enormous, but I think you have made just killer points today about the media's complicity in this, how the media has been gamed and has been gaming us. And I'm wondering if you have any final words of advice you might give to those of us who are activists as to what we can and should be doing to move forward in getting our word out, trusting that the small steps will add up to large steps, will add up to us being able to turn this around.
This is kind of like World War II in a way. All kind of things are going to have to be done and must be done and have to be done. The plan for those 7 to 11 nuclear plants on Long Island was finally stopped by people functioning politically, doing direct action.
By attempting to influence media and making their own media. I mean, a variety of tools were used. And the result was, Shoreham, though it was completed, the first of the series of nuclear plants never went into commercial operation. It was closed. And the scheme for a 7 to 11 nuclear plants never got off the ground. Likewise, I think people have to use whatever they're comfortable with, whether it's civil disobedience, direct action, media work, political work, legal work, whatever, and do it locally with your local anti-nuclear group, your local safe energy group, doing it nationally with organizations like Beyond Nuclear, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, Greenpeace, among others. and become active on this issue, very active on that. Decades ago, the slogan was active today or radioactive tomorrow. And I'm afraid, well, as the fallout from Fukushima continues to spread over this country and over this world, people are becoming impacted by that radioactivity. We must stand up and just stop this demonic force that has warped our energy future and in terms of media has just corrupted American media.
Carol Grossman, this has been an amazing talk. I think you have given us plenty to think about. What I'd like to do is let people know what your website is, because you do have available a free download of your book, Cover Up, What You Are Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. So would you please give us your website?
Yeah, it's just people should go to Carl Grossman, Carl with a K, Grossman, one word, .com. And the folks who published Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, actually wanted to put out a new edition after Fukushima, and I wrote a new intro, a 20-page intro, and nowhere. They couldn't get any interest in a new edition, but the publisher then just put the book right online, and you can download it for free online. Lots of documents and all that, and that new introduction in terms of television. Just go to envirovideo.com, one word, envirovideo.com. One I would suggest, this is one on Chernobyl, which I did a few days, 6 days before Fukushima, March 11th, began, and then I added a piece on Fukushima. It's called Chernobyl, A Million Casualties, and that's based on, speaking of media cover-up, a very, very important report, a book, published by the New York Academy of Sciences, done by a team of European scientists, saying that the consequences of the Chernobyl, 1986 Chernobyl disaster, excess deaths, particularly cancer, all around the world, and they present medical evidence of this. We're talking about 985,000 deaths they connect to Chernobyl. Have you read about that? Have you heard about that? Have you seen anything about that on mainstream media?
Mainstream media, no. I've only heard about it through our own channels.
You can watch that program for free, either at envirovideo.com or envirovideo.blip.tv. And just Google my name, and you'll see like many, 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 many articles. And folks should get active themselves, too, in terms of gathering information, disseminating information. I mean, this media revolution that we're undergoing, I think, can do an end run around, a successful end run around the hold of traditional media institutions by these evil influences, such as those behind nuclear technology.
Oh, my God, can we bottle you? Carol Grossman is an investigative journalist who has specialized in reporting in a variety of media on nuclear and other issues for more than 45 years. Thank you so much for being with us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Here's today's final thought. Last week's public meeting in Dana Point, California, between the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Southern California Edison, and citizens deeply concerned over San Onofre was a sham. We were gamed, and badly. SCE rented a triple ballroom at a five-star resort for $23,000, ratepayer money, mind you, and then filled the audience with hundreds of union workers from San Onofre who'd been told that we were disruptive activists and who then proceeded to treat the meeting like a pep rally, cheering each of their speakers like they just made a game-winning touchdown, booing our side, or simply refusing to acknowledge us. Most of them, not listening to anything, were just trying to stay in the good graces of their union. For our part, we had dedicated, big-hearted activists on stage, but nobody who could speak to the tech questions that we were restricted to asking. There were lies coming thick and fast from the other side, commented upon by Twitter feeds. This included a hormesis advocate who insisted that radiation is good for your health. But the lies were allowed to stand. Tough questions from the audience were ducked, and nobody held the NRC's or SCE's feet to the fire. Then, within 2 days, we learned that Southern California Edison had already taken the steps referred to in our lead story to prepare for a restart before November 1st. They're calling it a test to see if the reactor still leaks. but they haven't done the necessary repairs, and the only way to see if it's still leaking is to power it up to 100% and then wait to see if anything falls apart, with, of course, radiation included. This is psychosis. This is psychotic behavior by people who think they are in the right, doing things for money that can doom our planet's life to an inevitable extinction. Words fail me. Short-sighted? Arrogant? Evil? How can they be so divorced from the life force that they cannot see what they are doing? And how can they be stopped before they do something from which we will never recover? I have to keep reminding myself. David and Goliath. David won. If I forget, and I know I will, please, remind me. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 16, 2012. You can find our episodes posted on nuclearhotseat.com/blog, on the Facebook Nuclear Hot Seat pages, and on iTunes Podcast, where you can subscribe for free. Share us, link to us, graffiti about us. This is the activist voice on nuclear issues, so use us as the resource we are. And if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, do not go back to sleep.